This is CBC News.
Good evening, I'm Dwight Smith.
And I'm Allison Smith. This is The World at 6.
Tonight, the fog is lifting.
From tomorrow morning on, we should see progressively more planes start to fly.
Hope breaks through for travelers bound by volcanic fog.
A pedicure, a haircut, on doctor's orders?
Those who really need the services may not get them because somebody wanted a free pedicure.
CBC News reveals how some are ripping off their health insurance companies.
On the mortgage hook.
I just had never thought that 100% mortgage guaranteed by Her Majesty really makes any sense whatsoever.
Are Canadian taxpayers close to their own mortgage meltdown? That's coming up later. But first, Allison has our top story.
There are glimmers of hope for thousands of passengers stranded by that flight ban over much of Europe. Aviation officials in France, Germany, the Netherlands, and Britain announced some flights will resume tomorrow. Finally, a promise of relief after 5 days of frustration under a cloud of volcanic ash. The CBC's Tom Perry has the latest.
With flights to and from Britain grounded, UK citizens have spent days making their way to Calais in France to board ferries across the English Channel back home.
We left Finland at 3 o'clock on Saturday, ferry over to Stockholm, and then drove through, well, this is our seventh country, going to the eighth now.
After days of frustration, there was some good news today for travellers stranded across Europe and beyond. European transport ministers agreed to ease the flight ban that has grounded most air traffic across the continent for the better part of a week. Siim Kallas is transport commissioner for the European Union.
From tomorrow morning on, we should see progressively more planes start to fly.
Starting tomorrow, airports in Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Northern England will be open. British Airways hopes to begin flying out of London by tomorrow night. Paris is slowly opening up, as are airports in Germany and Belgium. It comes after several European airlines sent up test flights over the weekend to gauge flying conditions. The planes returned unscathed, leading some to question whether a flight ban was needed in the first place. Giovanni Bisignani is head of IATA, the International Air Transport Association. He calls Europe's handling of this crisis an embarrassing mess.
We needed some tests. We needed some test flights, go in the atmosphere, assess the level of ashes, and take decisions. After a couple of days pushing, the airline started to do those tests, and it came out in many cases the concentration of ashes was zero or very limited.
Aviation officials across Europe say they had no choice but to be cautious, and there are still words of warning about resuming flights. Britain's weather office says a test plane it sent up found dangerous levels of ash, and NATO says one of its jet fighters suffered damage to an engine when it flew through an ash cloud. Despite that, some commercial flights are set to begin again tomorrow, though travelers are already being warned that if the winds change or the volcanic eruption in Iceland gets worse, the cloud of ash could drift back over Europe and flights could be cancelled yet again. Tom Perry, CBC News, London.
Despite the better news coming out of Europe, here in Canada, frustrated travelers say they're getting little information. Some have now been stranded since Wednesday. Flights were briefly affected in Newfoundland and Labrador this morning, but it's unlikely the volcanic ash will have an impact on domestic air traffic. Nevertheless, Canadian airlines and the travel industry are starting to tally up the mounting cost of a cloud of volcanic ash. Philip Lee Shannock reports.
John Bromley is with the One Match Stem Cell and Marrow Network run by Canadian Blood Services. He says when the plume of volcanic ash cut off European and American airspace, it also severed a lifeline.
Obviously, we're talking about patients' lives here, and we are committed to serving our transplant hospitals, their doctors, and their patients. So time is everything.
Bromley says as soon as European airspace closed, patients waiting for transplants were placed at risk. London newspapers said a little girl was awaiting a bone marrow transplant. Her last chance of survival was an exact match from a donor in Canada. For others, the flight restrictions were less of a life-and-death nature. Mornay Cluter is missing his first day back at work. His vacation to Canada became extended by the volcanic eruption.
No idea when I'll be back in London. I was supposed to be back at work today, but I emailed my work and they understand. Completely out of my control. I mean, it's an act of God, so...
But he hasn't seen much of Toronto since he became stranded here on Thursday.
Especially, you don't know what's happening, so I can't decide to go somewhere else. But I don't know, you don't know, you just have to sit and wait.
News that flights could resume as soon as tonight is of little relief to Toronto literary agent Denise Bukowski. She had planned to attend the London Book Fair, which ends today.
Probably my airfare, my hotel, definitely my table at the London Book Fair, all the printing costs for all our catalogs and advanced materials. I won't be able to get those back.
John McKenna of the Air Transport Association of Canada says air carriers will have to absorb the costs of rerouting planes to bring people home. And even when flights resume, it will take weeks for schedules to return to normal.
It's basically dominoes, right? I mean, you're late one place, you're going to be late everywhere else. Anytime 30,000 flights are disrupted, it's going to have a ripple effect across the world.
As for the financial impact, expected to be in the billions of dollars, it could take months for the full costs to hit home. Philip Leshanock, CBC News, Toronto.
The International Luge Federation says the death of a Georgian luger at the Vancouver Olympics was unforeseeable. A report released today blames driver error, high speed, and other factors for the death of Nodar Kumaritashvili. The report concludes the track was safe. But as Teddy Katz reports, concerns about the track's speed came up years before the Games.
As soon as the track was completed, 3 years before the Games, the International Luge Federation says it knew it was faster than it was supposed to be. A lot faster. Athletes were supposed to reach a top speed of 136 kilometers an hour, but some were going almost 20 kilometers an hour over that. Because of those speeds, the Luge Federation had athletes do more training and built a safety barrier on the final curve, one that was quickly made higher after the tragedy. But the sport officials claim they had no way of foreseeing any athlete would fly off the course. Some athletes in the sport disagree.
Well, the reason that he's dead now is because the crash barrier on the exit of 16 wasn't high enough.
Patrick Singleton has competed at the Olympics for Bermuda and luge and skeleton events. He just missed qualifying for the Vancouver Games, but trained on the course in Whistler.
You know, you can have fast tracks, and you can have challenging, difficult tracks, but if you put the two together, fast and challenging, it's, you know, a recipe for disaster. And that's exactly what took place.
But the track's German designer says the speed shouldn't have come as a surprise to anybody. Udo Gergel says even before the course was built, sports officials knew these speeds were possible.
Already 2004, we have calculated, we make the design for the track for a speed from 150 kilometers per hour.
The head of the Vancouver Organizing Committee says he doesn't want to see another death at the Olympics. But John Furlong says he isn't sure anything could have been done to prevent it.
The report doesn't say that had the track been 5 kilometers slower or faster, it would have necessarily changed anything. They're talking about a whole unique set of circumstances that caused the particular thing that happened that catapulted the athlete off the sled and out of the track.
In the lead-up to the Vancouver Games, the Whistler track was being promoted as one of the fastest ever built. Even before the tragedy, luge officials said they wanted a slower track at the next Games. Teddy Katz, CBC News, Toronto.
And speaking of the Olympics, longtime speed skating official Jean Dupre is the new CEO of the Canadian Olympic Committee. He replaces Chris Rudge, who resigned from the job last month. Dupre spent 15 years as Director General of Speed Skating Canada.
I'm Michael Colton in Washington with a story on a provocative grassroots movement of gun owners who've taken to packing pistols in public just because they can.
It's the police's job to maintain order in society and to uphold the law, but it's everyone's own responsibility to defend their life if need be.
They're on the streets, in restaurants, in coffee shops, the open carry movement. I'll have that story later on The World at 6.
On the subject of gun control here at home, Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff is pushing to preserve a controversial measure, the Long Gun Registry. A private member's bill to scrap it is winding its way through the House of Commons. Last fall, it passed second reading with support from opposition MPs. But when the bill goes for a third and final vote, Ignatieff says his party will be united. Alison Crawford reports.
It's normal practice on private members' bills to allow MPs to vote according to their conscience. And that's why Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff won't allow his members to vote for Conservative MP Candace Hepner's bill to scrap the Long Gun Registry.
This is not a private member's bill. This is a government bill that doesn't have the courage to say it's a government bill. And we will whip it. Yes, we will whip it.
Last fall, many Liberals were deeply embarrassed when 8 MPs voted in favor of abolishing the registry for shotguns and rifles, created by the previous Liberal government. With the help of 12 new Democrats and an independent, the bill passed and it goes to committee next month. Speaking to the Canadian Police Association today, Ignatieff said a Liberal government would preserve the registry by making registration easier, dropping all fees, and on first-time failures to register their weapons, gun owners would get a ticket instead of a criminal charge. Anthony Rota is a Liberal MP from Northern Ontario. He says he can live with those changes and will vote with his leader this time.
The issues that I had brought up seem to have been addressed, and we're almost at a resolution.
20 years ago, Montreal police officer Yves Francoeur was one of the first on the scene of the École Polytechnique massacre. Francoeur applauds Ignatieff for promising to whip the vote.
I'm very happy today to see that there's going to be a party line on the vote from the Liberal, and I hope it's going to be the same thing with the NDP.
But NDP justice critic Joe Comartin says despite the party's commitment to gun control, that's unlikely.
Our votes may very well make the difference. It's still the position that this is a private member's bill, that we as a party do not whip private member's bills.
Comartin says the key to getting all members on side may be to amend the bill at committee next month. But some, such as Nova Scotia NDP MP Peter Stauffer, are, well, sticking to their guns.
Criminals don't register their guns in the first place.
It's also unclear whether all rural Liberals are on side with their leader. Newfoundland MP Scott Sims, for one, refused to say how he plans to vote. Alison Crawford, CBC News, Ottawa.
Prime Minister Stephen Harper says his government will bring in new legislation to make it harder for criminals to receive pardons. There was an outcry earlier this month when it was revealed that Graham James had received a pardon for sexual offenses he committed against minor hockey players. Harper says the current laws are unacceptable.
That, my friends, is how the laws have been written over the past few decades. Written when soft-on-crime attitudes were fashionable and concern for criminals took priority over compassion for victims.
Harper points out that under the current rules, Carla Homolka is eligible for a pardon this year. She was released from prison in 2005 after serving 12 years for her role in the deaths of two schoolgirls.
Former Conservative MP Raheem Jaffer is scheduled to testify before a Commons committee this week. Jaffer's accused of illegally lobbying Conservatives to support his company's renewable energy projects. But the NDP says it doesn't want the committee probe to jeopardize the RCMP's work on the matter. NDP MP Pat Martin has submitted a motion to postpone Jaffer's testimony. His concern is that evidence divulged in committee is privileged and cannot be used in any court action.
A 12-year-old boy from Calgary is at the center of an international tug-of-war. Noah Kirkman was visiting his stepdad in Oregon 18 months ago when he was stopped by police for riding his bike without a helmet and then handed over to social services. As the CBC's Scott Dipple reports, his mother wants the Canadian government to help her get him home.
Lisa Kirkman says if this was happening in China or Somalia, it might be believable. But her son is trapped in the United States, and she can't get him back.
I wasn't allowed to talk to him. On his birthday, it was on the 21st. I wasn't allowed to talk to him.
Now 12 years old, Noah Kirkman is in his fourth foster home. A judge in Oregon considers Noah's mother an unfit parent for allowing her son to go visit the boy's stepdad, and because his mother has a criminal record for growing marijuana when she ran a medicinal marijuana club in BC in 2003. That conviction prevents Lisa Kirkman from going to the U.S. without special permission. Social workers in Calgary have done a review of Kirkman and her home, declaring her able to care for her son just as she looks after her 7-year-old daughter. Kirkman says for about a year she was ignored by the Department of Foreign Affairs. Finally, they said, go away.
They said because it wasn't my husband who had abducted my child, because it wasn't a parental abduction, that they couldn't help me. Foreign Affairs said, I'm sorry, we can't help you. We don't deal with that.
Foreign Affairs later apologized and has now applied to have the U.S. return the boy to Canada. Kirkman's lawyer, Tony Merchant, says it's a highly unusual case.
We continue to think that we can persuade the judge that things just went off on a cockeyed direction and that Noah ought to be sent back.
An official with Oregon's Department of Human Services is not doing any interviews on the Kirkman case. In an email, an official said Canadian and American officials are working together to provide the appropriate assistance to the Kirkman family. Earlier this month, the judge in the case said he felt it was best for Noah to stay in Oregon until the end of the current school year. Lisa Kirkman says all of this could be resolved if the Americans would just let her son come home to his own mother.
I just want my son home. I didn't commit any crimes. He didn't commit any crimes. None of my family have committed any crimes. There's no reason.
Scott Dipple, CBC News, Calgary.
Around the office, they're the well-groomed co-workers, primped from frequent trips to the spa. But their health insurance providers know them only on paper as the people with bad backs and necks. A two-month CBC investigation reveals some spas are offering pricey treatments that aren't so squeaky clean. Joanna Romeliotis reports.
How's your skin feeling today?
A little bit dry.
A little bit dry? Okay, well, this facial...
It's an ugly little beauty secret. Spas that peddle pricey treatments with the promise it won't cost you a thing if you have health insurance.
Do you have an insurance something?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, so it's very easy.
Easy to trick your group health insurance company into covering something they won't. Anything from a facial to a haircut. And it isn't even hard to do. At this spa in downtown Toronto, you can buy a $500 aesthetic treatment package without spending a dime.
If you have insurance, we can write off for you. For example, if you pay $500, then we put it in Regis Massage Therapy. Your insurance company will pay for that amount.
We decided to test the offer and fork over $500 for a series of skin-smoothing treatments. In return, we got bogus receipts for registered massage therapy. All you'd have to do is mail in the claim and wait for the check.
That's fraud. That's theft.
Alistair Forsyth is a senior researcher at the Canadian Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association.
It's extremely widespread. You'll find it in every province, every city, every community across the country.
And easy to find. We dropped into 7 spas in the Toronto area to see for ourselves. 5 offered fake receipts for insurance coverage after we inquired. Experts say it's hard to grasp how much money is lost to this type of fraud. But we all end up paying for it, says Forsyth, with higher premiums and fewer benefits.
Ultimately, the victims are the patients themselves. And ultimately, those who really need the services may not get them because somebody wanted a free pedicure.
Joanna Romeliotis, CBC News, Toronto.
A new report from the Fraser Institute suggests Canadian families may be paying more in taxes today than ever before. The Policy Research Organization calculates the average Canadian family will give 41% of income to taxes this year. The Institute says it's the first time the average has topped the 40% mark since 1981.
New, tougher rules on mortgages are now in effect across Canada. People who want to buy a home or speculate in real estate now have to put more money down and prove they can handle higher interest rates. But what about all those zero-down 40-year mortgages available under the old rules not so long ago? As we hear from our economics reporter Mike Hornbrook, some experts warn they could be a huge liability for Canadian taxpayers.
No, there's some things that need to be done.
Yes, I do understand. Yeah.
Canadians are shopping for homes with new urgency these days as interest rates begin to rise along with taxes. But in the summer of 2006, as the subprime bubble was growing in the United States, Canadian banks, with Ottawa's blessing, started offering 0% down 40-year amortized mortgages. Ian Lee, who used to work as a mortgage manager for a chartered bank, says it was a risky move.
Because a zero-down payment 40-year amortization mortgage is a quintessential subprime mortgage. So
as the Harper government and the CMHC trumpeted the new affordability of homes, behind the scenes in Ottawa, there was dissension.
We thought that this was rather a poor idea.
David Dodge was the governor of the Bank of Canada then, and he was appalled. Dodge warned it would drive up the price of housing. There was also the small matter of repaying all that borrowed money with nothing down.
I just had never thought that 100% mortgage guaranteed by Her Majesty really makes any sense whatsoever.
Dodge took his concerns to Finance Minister Jim Flaherty, who authorized the looser rules.
This was very unhelpful at that point in time. One of the very few times, I think, that while I was there, that it was quite clear that the bank had a different view than the government on a financial issue.
The bulk of the 0-40 mortgages were insured by the CMHC. It will not disclose how much it's on the hook for. The CMHC will not disclose how many of these mortgages are in arrears or in default. It will only say the delinquency rate is a little higher than other mortgages. David Rosenberg is chief economist for Gluskin Sheff, a money management firm in Toronto.
The most important question is, will the delinquency rate or the default rate go up on these products as interest rates rise? And they probably will. The true test is going to be over the next 12 to 24 months.
Ian Lee, who now heads the MBA program at Carleton University, calls for some accountability on those 0-40 mortgages.
I know as a former mortgage manager that delinquency is correlated very, very strongly to the amount of down payment or equity in the property. And when you move to zero down payment, delinquency skyrockets.
The 0-40 mortgages stopped in the spring of 2008, but they could still be a debt time bomb for taxpayers. We don't know the size debt involved here because the CMHC is keeping the information secret. It's refused to release details to members of Parliament, and it has not responded to an access to information request from the CBC. Mike Hornbrook, CBC News, Toronto.
North American markets were up today as investors reassessed the potential damage from the fraud case against Goldman Sachs. The TSX added 32 points to close at 12,103. New York's Dow Jones gained 73. The NASDAQ was virtually unchanged. And the Canadian dollar lost about a sixth of a cent to close at 98.54 cents U.S.
The BC government has given the go-ahead to a massive hydroelectric dam. The project was first proposed 40 years ago, but many opposed the plan to flood about 5,400 hectares of the Peace River Valley. It's expected to cost at least $6 billion. The CBC's Kurt Petrovich was at the announcement in front of another dam in northeastern BC.
With the sprawling dam named after another premier as a backdrop, Gordon Campbell put an end to months of speculation and years of debate.
And the decision has been made.
Campbell says Site C, a smaller but no less controversial project downstream of the WAC Bennett Dam, will undergo an environmental assessment, meaning for all intents and purposes, it's going to be built.
We need all the energy we can create in British Columbia, and there's no better way than starting than with Site C here on the Peace River.
Site C, if it is built, will come online as early as 2020, just as BC's demand for electricity grows by as much as 40%, pushed by the use of electric cars and a population growth of 1 million. At a minimum, the project will cost more than $6 billion. Today, Campbell and a coterie of BC hydro officials touted the more than 7,000 construction jobs the new dam will create and the legacy it will leave for a province that's trying to become electricity self-sufficient. But at the tiny airstrip in nearby Hudson's Hope, a few dozen protesters gave the premier a glimpse of what's to come. A majority of people in the region don't want the dam built. It will flood more than 80 kilometers of prime farmland and wildlife habitat along the river. Karen Anderson is the mayor of Hudson's Hope.
We can give a good fight for this. We'll stand up for what's right for our community of Hudson Hope. And that's what we have to do now. We have to stand up. We're a little community of only 1,100 people. You know, we think differently about flipping our switch on up here than you do in Vancouver, probably. But anything that does not negatively impacts our community, we'll stand up and fight for that.
But it's not clear how much any group opposed to the dam can do. Today, Campbell made it clear the environmental assessment won't kill the project. It'll be a process to turn what in the past has been unaffordable, unnecessary, and unwanted into a legacy. Kurt Petrovich, CBC News, Hudson's Hope, BC.
This is The World at 6 on CBC Radio 1.
We're on the internet at cbcnews.ca. And for our latest podcast, go to cbc.ca/podcasting.
The two top al-Qaeda leaders in Iraq have been killed in a joint operation by U.S. and Iraqi forces. They were killed in a nighttime raid near Tikrit, the hometown of Saddam Hussein. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden called it a potentially devastating blow to the terror network.
They were packing pistols for all to see today in the Washington area, a provocative protest by the so-called open carry movement. The pro-gun lobby already has the few remaining handgun bans and weapons restrictions in their sights in the courts. But that's not enough for the protesters. They want to push the government to recognize the right to carry concealed weapons. Our correspondent Michael Colton has the story.
and I'll get a small buffalo pizza.
Pizza, Pepsi, and if you want, bring your own pistol. It's open carry night at Lido's Restaurant in Northern Virginia.
It's an Argentinian-made Bursa 9mm. It was made for the Argentinian police force.
Yeah, it's a semi-automatic Springfield Armory XD.
It's a Smith & Wesson revolver, 38 caliber.
They're armed up and flaunting it. In no less than 38 states, carrying a handgun openly in a holster in public is legal with few, if any, restrictions. But what gun owners like Tess Aylshire really want is the right to conceal or hide the guns they carry.
When I wear business clothes, I often will carry in a shoulder holster. I'd like to be able to keep my jacket on over it. I'd like there to be an option.
Groups of gun owners with what they call their meetups right across the country have launched an in-your-face movement. Armed, they walk down streets into coffee shops, restaurants.
I realized very early on that criminals prey on the weak and the unprotected. And when I carry a sidearm, they know I'm neither.
That's what's happened in America. Crime has been going down ever since gun carry has been going up.
I like open carry because it's a way of expressing my right to bear arms.
And if some people get nervous, all the better. Because for gun advocates, scaring the public with the open display of weapons just might make the battle for the right to carry them concealed all the easier.
There's at least 30, 40 people with guns just in there, just sitting on their hip. You know, they're not even police officers. It's just very disconcerting. And
Jennifer Pickett hustled out of the pizza joint in a hurry, her two kids in tow.
You know, if you're going to bring your children in, I definitely think, because our kids were scared. My 9-year-old just said, I want to go, I'm scared, and it ruined our dinner.
The monthly meeting of about 100 members of the Virginia Civil Defense League.
The weird thing about it was is that the press picked it up and they were saying it was the gun owners that were stirring all this up, and it wasn't at all. I think
the group's president, Philip Van Cleve.
Yeah, you know, we view it as a right. We view that your right to protect yourself is an inherent God-given right.
Well, unfortunately, in many states, our gun laws are far too weak in Virginia.
Daniel Weiss with the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence doesn't think God has much to do with the open carry movement.
It seems to be growing partly because folks are afraid to stand up to them. Corporations like Starbucks, Congress, and even the president have not done the right thing.
The open carry crusade is just the latest success for gun rights advocates, and they're savoring it. Michael Colton, CBC News, Annandale, Virginia.
And now to sum up, a glimmer of good news for stranded and weary travelers. As the cloud of volcanic ash begins to lift over Europe, aviation officials say some flights will resume tomorrow, but it could take weeks to fully clear the backlog.
Strict new rules on mortgages are now in effect across Canada. First-time buyers and speculators will now have to prove they can handle higher interest rates. The worry now is about the homeowners who already have mortgages beyond their means as rates begin to rise.
And that's our program for this Monday, April the 19th.
The World at 6 from CBC National Radio News. I'm Dwight Smith.
And I'm Allison Smith. You can follow up on any of these stories anytime at our website, cbcnews.ca. Have a good night.
Good night.